Welcome, everyone, to the next exciting edition in the Insights podcast series. I'm Tony Craddock. I'm the founder and director general of the Payments Association. I'm joined today by somebody who you really should hear about because he's got a really strong message to talk about things that are really important. Steve Round has had experience over the years as chair of the Ecology Building Society, 10 years as a chair of the Big Issue Foundation. He was a founder of the Change Account. He's a co-founder of Sascada, which is a cloud-native banking platform enabling banks to offer first-class banking services to all. And he's an NED at the Centenary Bank in Uganda. He's also chair of the Governing Board Forum at the Global Alliance Banking on Value. So, blimey, there's the credibility, there's the CV to die for. But what he's going to talk about is something that I think is really fundamental to the future of our industry and the world. And we're going to go jump straight in, Steve. And we're going to throw a question out to you. And the first one really is to do with how the E of ESG is really nothing without the S and G. And can you talk a little bit about first of all, some background on the ways in which ES and G factors affect the payments industry?
Of course, and thank you for inviting me to speak. I think there's a challenge that I have to the whole banking industry, whether that's be legacy banks or fintechs, that we are being pushed down an ESG agenda. But what does that really mean? What I saw when I was chair of Ecology was people saving with Ecology and then borrowing on mortgages, and every single loan was a green loan. They had the choice to be able to do that. And my concern in the financial services industry is that E is becoming a middle-class choice and people on lower income can't afford to make those choices. So for me, the S is fundamentally important to the E, and so is the G. And what do I mean by that? Because if you look at Project Drawdown, which is one of the major projects on the whole environmental climate change, education of girls in Africa is number 6 on there. And education itself is an important part of how we deliver environmental change. I come from a background where I'm probably more a social justice person than I am a financial justice person. But the reality is, if you give people the tools to actually make those choices, you can do that. We as financial services industry participants can do that more and more. And just to sort of bring that point to a conclusion, I suppose, everyone talks about the 1 billion that are unbanked. Well, according to the World Bank, there are circa 8 billion people in the world, which suggests to me in my basic maths that there are 7 billion people that we as financial services and fintechs have access to, and we can help on the S, supporting in different projects, different products, different services that then can help the E.
So how did you get into this particular solution set for the business? Because generally on this podcast, I love people not talking about their business, but in this case, it's a fascinating solution. Tell us a bit about it.
No bloody idea, really, Tom.
It just sort of happened.
It just happened.
We were just commenting earlier. It was about over 10 years ago we first met, and I was just cooking up my community thing, but you've been bashing on with this one for your whole career.
Yeah, I think the key for me, I've always been involved in disruptive financial services before the techies got all of the word disruptive. And I think that's been driven by my parents and having a social justice element. And I think in financial services, it was always difficult to challenge the way that the status quo was until the banking crash in many ways. Mm. Everyone wanted to be part of NatWest or Barclays. And what happened is, and I think probably with the growth, with it probably stimulated you on the when you started with emerging payments, that there was an opportunity then looking at technology and how that could change people's lives. And also the demise of the brands of the big banks. How could you change the products? And one of the things that I hate is the phrase financial inclusion. And it's not because I'm against inclusivity, I'm against inclusion. I saw so many times...
Distinguish between those things. It's really important.
It is to me, and people will argue, and I'm very happy to take the point. For me, having spent time with the Big Issue, a London Rebuilding Society, where we develop products and services for people on very low income. The challenge for me is financial inclusion products are generally someone going, you have that product, I don't need it, but you have it. And for me, financial inclusivity is the ability to actually offer a first-class product at the right price to everyone. Now, technology enables you to do that, actually, and on the same platform, because the best thing you can give anyone is self-esteem. Best thing you can do. And problem that some of the financial inclusion products that I've seen, both in the UK, Europe, and in Africa, can ghettoize people in a second-class product. I don't think that achieves the aim of what we all set out to do. And I think there are a lot of really good people out there who are trying to do these things, but do them in a way that don't treat people the way you should be. If I can give you a quick story, I was many, many years ago, mid-90s, I launched another initiative on a prepaid card called the Community Card, and it was aimed at credit unions. And I was in Ipswich presenting, and there was a cost to this card, as generally in payments, as we know, there are costs. And I must have sounded embarrassed. So there's about 200 in the audience. So this hand went up and he said, "Steve, can I stop you there?" I said, "Yes, of course you can." And I won't use the phrase he used, but you can probably gather that there was a letter missing. He said, "You're a middle-class twit." So I put my hand up and I said, "Can I stop you there? My mother would kill you if you call me middle-class." So we had a bit of a debate. And the point of principle was, you don't know me, he said. You don't know my financial or social being. You don't know that I live in Ipswich. My son lives in London. I don't have a bank account. So I don't get the discounts on the internet of the big bus into London. And he gave me a raft of things. And he said to me, and I'll never forget it. He said to me, "Give me the product. Give it very clearly what the pricing is. Let me make the judgments. We're not all flipping idiots." And that's and I learned that a long time ago, to create a first-class product, give people the really good facts and allow them to make the choices.
So is that what your business does now?
Well, our business is Sascada, is a cloud-native core banking platform. And going back to my financial inclusivity, we provide core banking to banks, EMIs around the world. And some of those banks are dealing with people on very low income, and some are, in Switzerland particularly, on high net worth individuals, all on the same platform. And that, for me, was what we were all about.
So do you remember a few years ago, the banks decided they would set up they were legally obliged to set up something called the basic bank account. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
Anybody inside this podcast studio should realise that the smoke is starting to come out of Steve's ears at this moment. And it didn't really work, didn't it?
Well, again, it's a second-class product. It wasn't giving people access to what they really want. I've never met anyone yet who has been, and a lot of that was aimed at people on very low income and or credit unions. I've never met anyone who wants to set up a credit union. What they want access to is a first-class affordable financial services product.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we fail in banking generally, and where I think the fintechs and the banks, legacy banks, can work together on delivering this. And you link that then to climate change, and you link that to net zero and all the things we can do. I think it's really important. One thing I would say, just on that point, is I think that banks historically waged war on poverty. I think they're waging war on the poor. And I believe that.
I mean, that's kind of not quite what they intended.
No. And again, it's looking at it in a different way. You look at it in that you offer a first-class product to someone. How do you do that? And you'll know through your members. Yeah, the ability of now, the cost of transactions gone down and down and down. But actually, why are we differentiating then on platforms? And that's a cost over there for a person who's on very low income, and that's a cost, and it's a different product set. No, just use the product differently. So an example would be, and you'll know, Tony, that when we set up the change account, the idea was we had wallets in there that people could actually secure and safeguard money for rent payments or any sort of priority payments. The same principle can be used for high net worth individuals who have five different wallets, who have got four different currencies and perhaps even a crypto. Same technology. Yeah, and you can move people through that sort of graph. And I've always believed that we can do more. And that gets me on my...
There's not... We don't have two internets, do we? You use the same Google that I use.
Absolutely.
You know, they're both equivalent. Exactly. They both give me world-class capability.
Absolutely right.
Very nice. So look, one of the things I wanted to probe into is whether ESG should receive the same focus. So, you know, I've heard you say that perhaps the E is less important within the ESG than the social and governance.
I'm saying that the E, unfortunately, we are, I think because of our products and services and the way we market it, are enabling that element to be given to people who can afford to make those choices. And I'm saying that if you create an S, and where banks, I think, can, and fintechs particularly now, because they can work really well with legacy banks, whereas I go back to that point, if we as bankers worldwide are at least interacting with best part of 7 billion people, what about loans? How many loans are we giving out? Doesn't really matter. If every single loan on loan origination had questions about impact, about job creation, about environmental, that, for me, and you can probably even discount it or incentivize people to go down that route, banks will be making a massive difference. because they would have one thing that they don't have at the moment, which is data. And data is fundamental to not only putting a nice, beautiful 35-page report, but actually on impact. And there is a difference between what's happening in banks, which is a 35-page report, and we're recycling the coffee cups in the canteen, and that's great, and we're planting a few trees, which is all good. No, loan origination and also transactional, because I think through your members, particularly when it comes to carbon footprints and the ESG working party, you can look at every transaction that someone makes now on their card or on their phone. You can actually give a question, or it gives the information. If you choose that one, it's got X tons of CO2, or that Y tons.
Very good. So you can align behavior with attitude.
Well, I think that's what you have to do. And I'll give you an example. When ecology has been going 40-odd years.
Ecology?
Ecology Building Society.
Oh, yes. Sir.
You started in 1983 by a number of crazy green nutters who wanted to create a bank, an enterprise building society, that was actually building a greener society.
Yeah.
I mean, in 1983, that was silly. It's now a 300-400 million balance sheet. But the reality is it incentivized people to change their custom and practice. So if your boiler rating was a C and you moved it up to an A and you had a mortgage with them, you'd get a discount on your mortgage. And that incentivizes people to make change. And that, I think, is where we're at now with some of the things that we want to do within the fintech banking communities around the world. We have to incentivize people.
So let's talk a little bit about the incentives there for change regarding the climate impact. You talked about impact earlier. What role do the various stakeholders play, you know, investors, regulators, consumer groups? What role do they play in driving some of these initiatives? Because will this happen naturally? You know, sometimes there's a sense that we don't need to be proactive and that actually this stuff will happen anyway. So why don't you just...
No, I think that's a very good point.
So how in other words, how much active initiation do we have to have?
Let me start with regulators and let me finish with regulators at the same time. They see climate change as risk. That's the challenge, that they see it from a lending perspective, risk. Also from a third party. So as you'll know, if you are outsourcing to a substantial third party, they'll want to know what their net zero plans are and everything. In essence, what difference does that make? Because there will be reporting, because they have to report to the regulator and they'll do those things. What I would like to see the regulator doing is seeing what impact banks make. And to be fair, I think it's organizations like yourselves. And I think, as you know, I chair the governing board of the Global Alliance Banking on Values. I think they have to make an impact. And what I mean by that, I have this sort of phrase in my mind, which is AIM, which is agitate, innovate, incubate, and mainstream. Because if you agitate, you make a point, you get in the press, you make all that, you innovate really interesting products, you incubate them to make sure they work, and then you mainstream. We need all the mainstream banks to actually start delivering real impact.
Do you think they have the appetite?
I think the simple answer is, in a 50,000 employee business, I'm sure they do. Do they have it at the top level? I'm not sure.
So my fear is that the people at the top of these organizations who are looking down the next 10 years of their career, they may be mid-50s, they may be retiring mid-60s, or maybe a little earlier. My fear is that they don't have the appetite to take the risks to affect the change.
And I would say, I'd add to that, that if you take post the crash and now the senior manager certification regime, I think particularly non-exec directors have a role, a massive role.
Yeah.
Because they now feel they're more liable. And of course, when you step down from a board now, you've got 6 years of history that if something has happened on your watch while you're there and it's fraudulent or it's not very good, you can be liable for that. I think decisions are not being taken. And if you look at, subject close to my heart, if you want data to create impact and help you actually understand the impact, you need data within your core banking platform. Mm-hmm. So does it stop banks, building societies, whoever, changing their core bank? Yes, it does, because they're going, not on my watch. I believe that actually. It's a challenge that we have to get through, and we have to raise the importance of delivering on that challenge.
So here's the irony. In an era where accountability is increasing, our need for them to have courage and to be bold is rising. So these two things are potentially contradictory, because the former implies less risk, but we actually think we need to have more courage.
I absolutely. And I would link that from a governance perspective, to also technology. Because, you know, gone are the days where you could sit on a board, a bank board or whatever, and go, well, Bill knows everything about technology, so we'll focus on him. I think it's incumbent on all banks to give all their senior management and their non-execs training, understanding of climate change, climate risk, what they can do, and the technological changes that are happening. Because as we know, AI will have exponential growth. And that has an impact on how you can then start to deliver at a local level. But banks can do practical things. So Bank Australia, who are one of the members of the Global Alliance on Banking on Values, they bought circa 2,000 hectares of land that nothing can be built on, and are using that to teach and educate people about the land. Yeah. And there are projects all around the world that these things are happening. And it's not, I don't see ESG. I mean, when I see a bank that has head of ESG, I worry. It's got to be the chief exec. It's got to be the chair. It's got to be the board, because it's how they do business. Because I do believe, Tony, that one of the elements that we've got, and I think the Payments Association and others have a role in this, is that if banks believe the only relationship they're ever going to have with their customer is transactional, they will die. It's got to be a communicative, and that is about climate, it's about risk, and it's about social.
Brilliant. So look, let's talk about the last 5 minutes or so about, you mentioned the Payments Association, the ESG Working Group has developed a really exciting initiative, the Carbon Framework Initiative. Yep. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, look, the reality is that carbon and carbon footprints are sort of hidden in many ways. And most of our SSCADAs and most new entrants use cloud. And cloud, of course, and software actually generates an awful lot of CO2 that no one sees. And I think it's important that we find ways of measuring that in a way that we can then explain that to the banks we serve, all the end customers. Because I think, again, giving customers choice is a really important part of incentivizing people and giving them what we can do. But also it's about we as bankers, fintechs, who are all providing services, to be more open and transparent anyway. And the challenge I think we have, and I think this comes down to regulation being bad sometimes, is that we're scared sometimes to be honest and open, that we haven't all got massive net zero plans that are brilliant, that are perfect. And I think there's a challenge there for us all. And I think the more that we can do through working groups on how we can framework that carbon, how we can work together, and how we can actually put that out in the open saying, that's what it is, that's what we're working towards, that's how we're going to deliver it, and in an open and honest way.
Yeah,
I think people will appreciate that. No one, you take a NatWest, the reality is a NatWest, it's almost impossible to get to a net zero in a way that they could do it, just because of the nature of the beast. I mean, we can all slag them off, that's nice in the press, but actually the reality is we all understand as professionals, that's going to be very, very difficult.
But they can take steps towards it.
And there's a great phrase that I'm nicking from Thomas Fuhr, who's the chief exec of GLS Bank in Germany. We're having a big debate at the Global Alliance about greenwashing. And he was one of the founders of the Global Alliance some 15, 16 years ago. And he said, stop. He said, 15 years ago, none of the major banks thought green was an issue. They're now greenwashing. That's the first step for them to see, because they now see it's important. Now we have to get them to deliver real green. And I think that's a really important message for me, that, yeah, we can all be zealots and we can all be pious, but let's take, yeah, and congratulate them on that and say, you've not done enough. And when someone says to me, well, we've got this one green product, oh, well, what about the other 59? And I'm old enough to remember that, you know, when you used to go into my local cooperative shop and there it was, the fair trade aisle. Well, there were seven that by definition weren't fair trade, but they got away without the retailers. And I don't expect the banking community to get away with it. Every single product, in my opinion, should be measured against an ESG framework, whether that's a lending product. Doesn't have to be, I expect everyone to be pious. But if you did that, one, you'd start to make a significant change on climate. Secondly, you'd make a significant change on social, because you'd be creating jobs and whatever. But thirdly, can you imagine the impact that is going to have? And banks can be seen as the real innovators and real deliverers, rather than the ones who are, to be brutally honest, getting coffee cups and recycling them in the canteens.
I think you've just raised the biggest challenge for our industry of the era, actually. And I'm, you know, welcome you sharing it so explicitly and clearly, Steve. Thank you. I wish we had a lot longer, but these are I have a George is our editor here, is ruthless in keeping these in time. But the good, I'd like to just sum up. I think there's a word that I'd like to add to your AIM framework. Yeah. You talked about agitate, innovate, incubate, and mainstream. And I love those four things. There's something, there's another A at the beginning. So it's sort of double A, I, double I, M, which is amplify. And that's what you're doing today. You've always been a great spokesperson. You've always fought for this cause. You've always been somebody who not only expresses your views clearly, but also makes sure they're amplified to the market. So Steve Round, co-founder and CEO of Sascada, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony. Much appreciated.
To access more podcasts, videos and articles, go to thepaymentsassociation.org.